The Nisqually earthquake on the 28th of February 2001 measured 6.8 on the Richter scale, lasted for nearly a minute, and caused about $200 million worth of direct damage. If you can believe that, it's a very big number. And for the purposes of this story, the most significant damage was to the elevated highway running along Seattle's waterfront, the Alaskan Way Viaduct. I'm Dominic Black.
And I'm Kiku Hughes.
And this is an 8-year-long emergency. Seattle, an earthquake, and a doomed waterfront highway. Episode 2, Earth versus Viaduct.
I'm Jared Smith. I grew up in Seattle, became a civil engineer, was involved in the earliest days of the viaduct when the earthquake hit as the head of transportation policy and planning for the city, and then eventually as a consultant working on the different alternatives, culminating my career at the city by returning as the director of the newly formed Office of the Waterfront.
Thank you very much. We're going to be going to NPR News in just a moment. Michelle in Columbia City.
I was working for the mayor. Then it was Paul Schell.
And I ran out heading toward the street, and I thought, no, you're supposed to stand under the doorway. And I was under the door, and I was...
A strong earthquake shook Seattle and other parts of the Pacific Northwest today. Local hospitals are reporting...
Having coffee with a friend, and the chandelier started swaying, and then all the dishes in the cafe started flying.
So I passed by the conference room and got in the elevator with the deputy mayor.
The building began cracking up the bricks. It was just ripping open the bricks. And I thought, oh boy, get out of here.
Got off on the second floor where my office was, and just then the earthquake hit.
And I grew up in California, so my immediate thought was, oh my God, earthquake.
I started to run, and in front of me, a woman was stopped by a plate glass window that just stopped and shattered in front of her. She stopped and crouched to the left.
And I began to hear things snapping in the building.
And I thought, oh boy, get out of here.
So I turned to Chuck Clark, and I said, we need to get out of here.
Our instructions to everyone is, if there is an aftershock, that you drop, cover, and hold on. Get under something heavy and hold on to it, because it might be moving across the room with you.
I seriously thought that bad things were going to happen in the municipal building. And so we exited the building, ran out onto the side street, I believe it was Columbia, and the first thing I did was look down the street to see what was the situation with the viaduct, expecting that it might have collapsed. And around us were construction cranes waving in the air. The street was literally like waves, and we were actually knocked to our feet standing on the sidewalk there. Fortunately, we saw the viaduct was still standing.
That sound that you're hearing right now is the traffic on that once upon a time viaduct.
When we were here in the 90s and early 2000s, there's 85 decibels of background noise coming off the viaduct.
Bob Donegan's the CEO of Ivor's Restaurant. It's a very famous institution in the Seattle area, and it's also right on the Alaskan Way.
You couldn't walk up and down Alaskan Way and have a conversation with someone unless you were shouting. It was not a pleasant place to be.
Bob Donegan reckons he went to over 1,000 meetings in those early discussions about how to replace the viaduct. And yet, there's people living here now who don't even know what it was. They don't even know it was ever there.
All the tire dust and dirt and concrete off the viaduct rained down on people. It created a physical barrier between the city, residents and offices and the waterfront. We got these incredible views. You couldn't see any of them because there was an 80-foot structure in the way.
This really is a sound from the past. It's vintage. It's vintage Seattle. It was recorded, I think, in 2010 as the viaduct was still a conduit for roughly 110,000 vehicles a day, as they used to say. And as we'll hear in this and future episodes, the debate about how to replace the viaduct sucked up a massive amount of time and energy. And yet, as I said, there's people living here who didn't even know what the viaduct was. And I kind of liked it in some ways because there was, you know, something about it that was just, well, it's utilitarian. It just was what it was. There was no attempt to be decorative. It was just a thing. You know?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I grew up in the Seattle area, and one of my favorite things to do when I was in high school was take the bus from my, you know, suburbs outside Seattle and into downtown, down to Pioneer Square, walk through the, under the, you know, the pillars of the viaduct, see the vandalism and the posters, see shows down there. And so I always felt like the waterfront and the viaduct in its own way was a big part of what Seattle was to me as growing up. It was, you know, sort of gritty and kind of grungy and made you feel like you were, you know, really in a metropolitan, lively, unpolished area.
The magic of cities is in part to be found in the accidental spaces that are created, spaces that people sneak into and slide into and establish themselves in.
It was kind of neglected in a lot of areas. But that meant that there was a lot of really interesting art happening, people were able to get away with stuff. I mean, in our other podcast, History Link's other podcast, Square One, we talk about the forgotten LGBT history of Pioneer Square and how the sort of neglected nature of the area kind of allowed, you know, that subculture to thrive and get away with more than they could elsewhere in the city.
The way people talked about the viaduct later in its life, it was almost like it was an affront to what the city wanted itself to be. If you can say that a city wants itself to be something, I don't know if that's kind of personifying things too much. But I remember talking to the writer Knut Berger about this in 2011, and he said to me that sometimes in Seattle, even the most prosaic issues can sometimes have, or seem to have, a moral dimension, which I find really interesting.
I've noticed over the years, and I don't know if this happens in other cities, but certainly in Seattle, everything gets evaluated in a very utopian light. I believe that there's sort of a sense that we here in Seattle, which was settled much later than many American cities, we went from the covered wagon period to the modern age more quickly than most American cities. I mean, literally from covered wagons to jets in a very short period of time, unlike Boston, unlike New York. I think there's always been a sense of high idealism here, and it's split. Many of the idealists come here, and their goal is to build the next New York City. Many idealists come here, and their vision is to build something that is better and newer than anywhere else, an ecotopia or a world-class city or the launch pad for the space age. There's some, and sometimes those visions overlap a little bit, but often they don't, and often they conflict. So that every decision we make is often infused with a kind of moral righteousness, where we don't just look at a highway project as a highway project. We view it as a statement about our values. And that's where I think some of this public debate and some of the consensus gets snagged. It becomes a place where it's not simply reasonable people disagreeing. It becomes you rapacious rapers of the planet versus airy-fairy visionaries with no practical sense whatsoever. I mean, there's kind of a charge to everything. And I certainly don't sense that that exists with every project in every city. But here, if you talk about plastic bag taxes or the latte tax, which proposed a few years ago, if you talk about traffic circles, if you talk about zoo animals in Seattle or circuses in Seattle, if you talk about dams and salmon, if you talk about bicycling, if you talk about driving, all of these things have become kind of ultra-morally charged. And I think that is kind of a fascinating dimension to our politics, because practical things suddenly become these large conceptual good versus evil debates. And we have to somehow work our way through that to get to a practical solution.
So that chat with Knut Berger, as I said, was recorded in 2011. And when I listen back to that, even now there's parts of it that feel very much of that 2011 era. I don't know if that makes any sense. Like, I mean, you don't really think of yourself as living through a particular era, but I listened to, you know, quite a few of the older interviews in this series. There's a few different interviews that were recorded back then, and it struck me that we talked differently about the place from that. We talked differently about the place now than we did 10 years ago. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Which place do you mean?
Seattle.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Seattle's changed a lot in the last 10 years.
But it's only 10 years. I mean, it's a fart in the wind, you know? It's like a tiny little click of your fingers.
I guess so, but yeah. I mean...
yeah, so such is the exponential pace of change in the city that 2011 can seem further away from 2024 than it does from 1951, if you know what I mean, when work first started on building the viaduct.
People who like the viaduct, you know, have brought up this fact that it's sort of poor man's waterfront. That, you know, if you drive along the surface streets along the waterfront, you can't see the waterfront because of all the warehouses. If you drive along First Avenue or Western, you can't see the waterfront because of all the warehouses. The viaduct was the way you were elevated. And I remember when the monorail, the Green Line, was being touted and their slogan was "Rise above it all." Well, the monorail was this kind of futuristic almost roadway in which you could ride above at high speed above the sort of nitty-gritty of the city and have this spectacular view of the Olympics and Elliott Bay. So it's funny to say that because nobody really thinks of the viaduct as a pretty thing in itself now.
What do people think of it as?
Well, I think most people, there are some people who have some nostalgia for it. Most people see it as a wall or as an impediment to a future vision of Seattle, that it's outlived its usefulness, it's creaky, it's unsafe, it is kind of a relic of a city that was more industrial than the city we envision now, a city that was more car-friendly in the past than it might be in the future. And so it's not just a roadway, it's a roadway that some people look at as a very practical, necessary thing for moving freight around and for being able to commute from one end of town to the other. But a lot of other people look at it as this sort of impediment to a vision of a more perfect Seattle.
Jared Smith, who we heard at the top of the episode, engineer, civil engineer who worked for the city, also worked in consultancy and sort of moved between those two spheres over the whole period that we're talking about here. And he grew up in Seattle on North Capitol Hill.
I remember in my early days when I was taking swim lessons at the YMCA downtown, riding with my dad back at the end of the day, and he and others that were also civically engaged talking about the blight that was the new viaduct that was maybe, 12 years old by then.
So that's really, even then?
Yeah, that was my first kind of memory of the viaduct and its impact on Seattle.
What were the things that people were saying about the waterfront? Like, how was the waterfront perceived generally by Seattle from what you remember?
Well, my earliest memories were going down to the waterfront with my father, and we would meet for lunch at Lowell's or the Athenian. And then I have memories of going down in the early 1960s, mid-1960s. And in those days, it was a working waterfront. Most of the piers were still active, fishing boats coming in and out. My dad had been in the Navy, so he had a particular interest. And so he would somehow finagle his way onto these piers, and we would actually get on some of the ships. They were sending, things out. I remember even a ship loading barbed wire being shipped to Vietnam during the Vietnam War. And so it was a working waterfront, kind of stinky, and it had the beginnings of some of the tourist, elements, the old curiosity shop and, of course, the ferry terminal. And then eventually the aquarium was built there. So it was kind of in this transition.
The waterfront has always been a kind of transitional space. I really like the word liminal to describe it. It captures something about being between solid ground and salt water. And when you look at old images of the earliest days of white settlement, the new wannabe city seems to be hanging by a thread. The waterfront, this narrow ribbon of precarious timber construction.
Extremely precarious.
Jennifer Ott is an environmental historian. She's a director of HistoryLink, and she's the author of a new book on the history of the Seattle waterfront.
Extremely precarious, particularly once you get to motorized vehicles, because the entire waterfront from Western Avenue westward to the piers was built on pilings, and the planking went across those pilings. And so the entire neighborhood's sort of on stilts, the tide's passing underneath it every day. And the problem that really developed is that as vehicles were able to be heavier because they had motors and they were not horse driven, they were too heavy for that planking and they would fall through on a somewhat regular
basis. Did that actually happen? Yeah.
Oh, multiple times. And sometimes train cars would fall through because you also have the problems of the shipworms and the gribbles eating away at the wood and weakening it. And it's incredibly expensive to replace the planking. It's just this absolute suck on the city budget and they're very frustrated by it. But the challenge is that all the other north-south streets in Seattle are on hills. They have streetcar lines on them. They have tons of people crossing the streets because there's businesses on both sides. And so the waterfront is sometimes seen as the easier way through town if you're going from the south end to the north end. And so those plank streets just really bore a lot of vehicle traffic.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask you, Jen, sorry. Can we define sort of when we say people are trying to move north and south through the city, where is it that they're going?
They're moving from, let me think of the best way. So in the early years, that means that they want to get the trains in and out of the city. And in order to do that, they either have to go north through Inner Bay and along Lake Washington and eastward, or they have to go southward and go through the Duwamish River Valley and then go eastward. And so that north-south is really with the end goal of going east-west, but they can only go north-south because of the hills that run between Seattle and the Cascades and the Giant Lake, of course, that's there. And so you have to go north-south to get to the east-west routes.
This is all about physical geography and overcoming it, conquering it. And if you remember the viaduct, it's two levels. In cross-section, it looks kind of like a capital H. And the line across the middle is the southbound lanes. And there's a line across the top that forms the northbound lanes. So it's a pretty good space-saving design because of the fact that it's stacked like that. It's a 1950s design, or 1940s design really, for a 1950s problem. And it's built tight up against the western edge of the existing city. And by the way, you should totally check out the photographs in the city archive of the construction of the viaduct. They're amazing and they capture something about the epic nature of it. I know, they're pretty incredible. Maybe it's just because they're monochrome, but yeah, they're phenomenal. So check those out. Here's Jared Smith again.
So what happened in the earthquake, it's founded on, in many cases, timber pilings. So concrete foundation buried in the ground with the bents or piers going up in the air. And then there's the lower deck, which was the southbound deck, and then the northbound deck was the upper deck. And so if you go down into the ground, those timbers weren't necessarily driven until bedrock. So they were just sitting there, and they were held there by friction.
Friction. Friction is the spirtle standing up in your porridge. It's the breadstick standing up in your hummus.
And so when that non-engineered fill began to shake, you had a number of areas where the piers settled. And it was amazing that it didn't settle in a more dramatic way where, you know, it would have been an issue of life and death. But in the Pioneer Square area, there were some particular piers where it settled dramatically. And that was what was the real cause for concern. And then there were other areas. So they came through.
They being the Washington State Department of Transportation, WSDOT for short.
So they came through, did emergency repairs with the idea that it would probably need to be taken out of service within the next 2 to 3 years. So we did an emergency, a very accelerated alternatives process that year, the year 2001. And by the fall of that year, had identified a preliminary preferred alternative, which was the original cut and cover tunnel.
So cut and cover does pretty much what it says on the tin. You dig a huge trench, you cover it up with a lid.
And there were ideas of either having the roadway stacked on top of each other or doing them side by side and then building back over a concrete deck. Very similar to, there's areas, I'm trying to think of a local area, but you see it on 520, SR 520 and on I-90 where you have cut and cover tunnels and then building parks on top, both on Mercer Island and Sam Smith Park in Seattle.
So this is pretty quick. The earthquake is February 2001, and by the autumn, the cut and cover tunnel is singled out as the best replacement option. And here maybe we should take a breath, because we're entering a whole new linguistic realm. It's the realm of concrete tunnels, cut and cover twin and deep bore tunnels, the EIS and the draft EIS and the supplemental draft EIS. It's the realm of committees and forums and resolutions and legislatures, councils and ordinances, working groups, design charrettes and public ballots, the port and the unions, consultants and philanthropists, stakeholders, so many stakeholders. And there's more. Because the viaduct has an invisible twin, the seawall. And already, before the earthquake, city engineers know its days are numbered. So come 2001, they're like, basically, why let a good crisis go to waste?
The sleeping giant was the seawall. If the seawall was to fail, then everything behind the seawall would fail. What was how it was built was with what are called timber relieving platforms. And this was prior to treated timber. So as they were doing this work prior to the earthquake to evaluate the situation, they realized that that timber relieving platform had been eaten away by the gribbles, which are, you know, microscopic level little bugs. And I remember they had done some excavation and brought out some of the what were supposed to be timbers, and you could literally crush them in your hand.
Interestingly, the seawall was never engineered to completely keep the water out. It was just engineered to keep enough water out. And so as the water passes through the structure fairly regularly, you get areas where there are some settling of the fill, and there's voids that have a combination of wood, oxygen, and water. And that brings in the problems.
Voids.
The voids,
you
yes.
You don't want voids.
You do not want voids. There's also some issues with the seawater is corroding the steel elements of the seawall over time, and the tidal action is eroding the concrete and weakening the structure.
Parts of the seawall did fail during that earthquake and had to be repaired. So the idea was that since you had to repair or replace the seawall, that if you could make that the exterior wall of a new tunnel, then you would get kind of a double, a twofer in terms of the benefit of construction. So as you're building, you would build the new exterior of the new seawall. That would become the exterior wall, the western wall of the tunnel. And then you would basically build a concrete tunnel. And it's a very standard methodology that's used all over the world where you do cut and cover versus a bored tunnel.
It's an engineered solution to the same problem engineers in the city have always faced. The tension between the intrinsic nature of the space in which the city exists and the uses to which we as humans want to put that space, the things we want to do there. And that tension is a thread we can follow back to one of the most significant figures in the city's history since white settlement, R.H. Thompson. The place carries the imprint of so much of his work. He's visionary, he's practical, he's political, he has big ideas, and he knows how to make them happen. And my sense of him is he's a cleanliness is next to godliness, is next to industriousness kind of guy, like a the devil makes work for idle hands type of fella. When he dies at the age of 93, it's 1949. Just to give you some perspective, that's a year before my parents got married, right? A couple of years before construction starts in the viaduct. That's how recent this all is. That's how new this city is. How fast this all happened from white settlement to now.
Well, yeah, when you think about 170 years, that's two 85-year-old people lying head to foot. That's really not that long ago that this really abrupt change happened.
Carl Thrush is the author of Native Seattle, Histories from the Crossing Over Place.
Of course, it started earlier. We have to always remember that the epidemics shape all of this, and those would have started coming through in the late 18th century in repeated waves into the later 19th century. And those epidemics, which killed up to 90% of the population within the first century of contact, absolutely make the rest of the history possible. And so we can never forget that story, that part of the story. The epidemics made, in some ways, resistance less effective simply because of numbers. One of the phrases that historians use sometimes is demographic swamping. And that's absolutely what's happening in the 1850s into the 20th century, is just the massive influx of settlers and new immigrants into the region that just swamps the indigenous population.
That vision that R.H. Thompson had for Seattle was only possible on a landscape that was already made ready by the forced dispossession of the indigenous inhabitants of the land. So that would be mainly the Duwamish at that point. And that, you know, cleanliness, godliness, industriousness that you talk about, you know, that's all, again, part of what makes a good empire builder. You know, somebody who is embodying the moral code of the time and using it to shape, you know, an entire landscape. Who could think that they could do that except for somebody who is so high on the idea of their own position in empire?
Alan Stein wrote the History Link biography of R.H. Thompson. He leveled hills, says Alan Stein. He straightened and dredged waterways, reclaimed tide flats, built sewers, sidewalks, tunnels and bridges, and paved roads. He was instrumental in creating the Cedar River watershed, City Light, the Port of Seattle, and the Hiram M. Chittenden Locks. In fact, virtually all of Seattle's infrastructure can be attributed to R.H. Thompson. So says Alan Stein. And the flattening hills, that's the regrades. And if you're new to town and you don't know what the regrades are, Jennifer Ott's going to explain them to you, because they're amazing.
The regrades on one level are the manifestation of just this utter belief that you can engineer your way out of anything. And the idea is that Thompson saw Seattle as a bit like a sink, where the sides are sloped down to the bowl that is the bay. And he sees every single hill in Seattle as an impediment to development. And had he had his way, he would have leveled them all. But it turns out it's super messy, super expensive, super disruptive to level hills in the middle of a city. So he only got away with doing a few of them. And he moved millions of cubic yards of soil as he was leveling those hills. They would use they're called hydraulic giants. They were like big hoses, and they would sluice the soil down into the bay, or they would shovel it onto conveyor belts and convey it down to the water onto barges that would go out to the middle of the bay and dump themselves, self-dumping scows. So they were doing this over, the earliest was the 1870s, and that was a fairly minor one, into the 1920s, and that's when they finished Denny Hill, an entire massive Seattle hill removed in what is now the Denny Triangle area. And the idea is that you can't develop an industrial base if you don't have level land on which to do it. And you have to remember that when this starts, the tide flats extend all the way to the foot of Beacon Hill. That entire area that is now known as SoDo were tide flats.
And so how did they fund this, right? Because it's quite interesting. There's an interesting parallel here between the new waterfront development and this,
yes,
right?
It's a clever system. The standard practice at the time is that if there needed to be a public improvement on the public right-of-ways adjacent to privately owned land, then those private landowners paid a portion of the improvement. Part of the improvement was covered by just the general fund of the city, but part of it was paid for by what was called a local improvement district, which was formed of all the properties that would benefit from the project, and they were each assessed a tax based on how much of a benefit they received, what the square, or I'm sorry, the linear feet of sidewalk or whatever it was that was being improved, the sewer lines that were put in. The interesting thing about it, though, is that a majority of the property owners could block a project if they didn't think that it was well-designed or they didn't want to pay the assessment.
So in this, I had in my head that the fill used to create the waterfront comes from the Denny regrades, but that's completely not right. The Denny regrades was that area north of downtown that used to be hilly and used to be a mess, and there are those amazing photographs of the buildings left standing on mounds of earth, like that hotel. What was that hotel?
The Washington Hotel.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was just left on top of the dirt until they could dismantle it and then remove the dirt underneath it. What's interesting, though, is that to everyone's chagrin, all of that soil that was being sluiced down was not used to fill the central waterfront because they had not yet figured out how to fund the seawall construction. Some of the regrades did fill what's now known as the Soto neighborhood, but the central waterfront, that all comes after the regrades in the 1930s, all of that fill. And it comes from the mouth of the Cedar River in Lake Washington.
So when does the seawall start to be built?
South of Washington Street, the first seawall was built in 1916, and that extends southward over the Teens. It's built all the way to the mouth of the Duwamish River, and that's when you get the filling of the tide flats that follow in piecemeal over time. And then north of Washington Street would not be built until 1934, and it was completed in 1936. And that seawall extended all the way to Bay Street, which is now the north side of the Olympic Sculpture Park. And that is the steeply sloped part of the central waterfront. The seafloor is steeply sloped, and it just required an entirely different design, and a much higher cost was associated with it.
Right. But it is this series of projects that enable the quote-unquote waterfront that we know today, roughly speaking, to be created.
Right. Before they built the seawall, there was an article in the paper in 1909 complaining that the waterfront was the makeshift waterfront, because it was just constantly having to be replaced and repaired, the pilings and the trestles and the planking. And so until they built that seawall, there was no solid ground. All the buildings were on pilings. All the streets, of course, were on pilings. And so it required that improvement, but it also required a local improvement district, which same thing as the regrades and all the other public improvements. And the railroads and pier owners repeatedly blocked the local improvement district that would have paid for the seawall because it was tremendously expensive.
Mm-hmm. But it's that waterfront then constructed from fill and held in place by the seawall, into which construction crews in 1950 begin pouring concrete that will form the supporting columns for the Alaskan Way Viaduct.
It's pretty crazy that seawall creates a hard edge and it's stable edge, and they can fill behind it. And then that fill is a good portion of what is holding up the viaduct after it's built. It's not; it is resting on the glacially compacted soils, but the fill is part of the stability of the viaduct.
And, you know, it's easy to think about these as just construction projects. We see this all the time in a city,
yeah.
Things getting built, things getting torn down and built on top of each other. But, you know, it's important to remember that this act of building a seawall, this act of reorganizing the shoreline, it is an act of violence in that it is an essential part of the colonial project. And, you know, I think
So when you say it's an act of violence, what do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, as we talked about before, colonialism is in itself a violent act. It's a violent project. And there is no part of the colonial project that is free from, you know, a sense of violence. You know, we think of colonialism, we think of especially the early American colonialism as a fixed point in time where wars were fought, you know, people were displaced, people were murdered, and that was sort of a time in the past. And then it's done. Yeah, now we're living in a new era where, you know, we're all on this new country, in this new country, America. But when we look back at all the steps that it took to get here, we're still sort of living on the tidelands that were filled in downtown Seattle that were essential to creating this project that is an imperial city in an empire.
Does that ring true, Jen, from the historian's perspective?
It does, because a lot of these things do seem moments in time when they're really a long process of change. And at any time, we could choose to undo them. I'm not saying that that would be easy, but it is a choice that we continually make, that we are going to keep these things that have radically transformed the landscape. And it's worth at least acknowledging that we're making that choice.
Next time on an 8-year-long emergency, Seattle, an earthquake, and a doomed waterfront highway.
The state wanted to put the viaduct back up.
There was strong support there for a new elevated structure.
We're like, WashDOT, why are you replacing that highway? City of Seattle, why are you even entertaining the idea of rebuilding a highway?
I literally would have stood in front of the bulldozers if that had been what they forced on us.
This series has been made possible thanks to our sponsors, the Washington State Department of Archaeology and Historic Preservation, King County, the Port of Seattle, and the City of Seattle's Office of the Waterfront and Civic Projects. To find out more about the history of Seattle's waterfront, visit us at historylink.org.